We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries and creatives, and stories, music and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. We start today's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Roadside Memorial. Then we hear a song from a beautiful production of The Band's Visit called Answer Me. The Band's Visit is currently showing at the Dolby Theater through December 19th. More information about The Band's Visit at BroadwayInHollywood.com. Then we'll hear a tune by Aaron Schneider on accordion, Give Me Your Hand, followed by my radio colleague John Schneider interviewing Mac Gurgich. Mac Gurgich has an album out called Mac Bach, which has been nominated for a Grammy. And that is followed by a talk by Philip Holm, who has a channel on YouTube called Let's Talk Religion. He discusses numerous important religious figures, including Islamic scholars and mystics. And in this talk, we find out about Ibn Saba'in. And after Philip's talk, we hear a tune that he produced with his band called Ikar, called Blinded by the Lights. Philip Holm is one talented guy. Stay tuned.
The land in southwest Georgia is as flat as a billiard table. We had visited family in Cordial for dinner, the noon meal in the south, and we were headed to Albany to visit with old friends the Howells, Clayton, Athalia, Ricky, and Freddie. The Graybone family had left Albany for Macon in 1953, but we maintained good relationships with old friends. This was the era of the written letter, not even the telephone call. It was a year later, time for a visit. It was wet there. Some parts of the road had water that pooled there all year long. The water looked cool, clear, and calm. I remember my mom sending me wading into one of those pools to collect water lily blossoms. We were cruising along in the afternoon, and we came upon skid marks on the road, and the pool in the ditch beside the road looked like someone had plowed it up. The water was clear, but the terrain looked rough, and there were various pieces of a car here and there, broken glass, headlights, taillight lenses, etc., the detritus of an automobile accident. There on the shoulder of the road was a funeral wreath. It was a round arrangement of yellow flowers on a metal stand, the type you see left standing in a cemetery. The Georgia heat had done its work on the flowers. They were well wilted and turning brown. I'd never seen anything like this before, and I asked my parents about it. My dad explained that someone had been killed in a car crash there. Someone, most likely a family member, that loved the deceased had left the floral arrangement as a memorial. From that point forward, I used to see roadside memorials to people killed in car crashes. For a while, crosses were a big thing. Sometimes one, sometimes two, sometimes a lot more, often on a curve or a part of the road that had bad sight lines. You don't see many crosses today, not like you used to. There was a guy in Texas that made crosses out of cedar with mortise joinery, stainless steel screws, and two coats of finish paint. You could order a cross from him, and he would make it and install it in any state in the Union. He spent his winters making crosses and spring and summer installing them. He had a list of locations and a pickup truck full of crosses. His crosses were meant to last, and they did. The roadside memorial is not a U.S.-only theme. I've seen them all over the world. In Paris, the tunnel abutment where Princess Diana was killed 20-plus years ago is still decked out with flowers, gifts from admirers. The news a few weeks ago that the United States had surpassed 700,000 deaths from COVID-19 and we're still losing 2,500 people a day, 95% of whom are unvaccinated. I began to think we should memorialize these people, like some of the people that are killed in automobile accidents. First, we have to come up with a suitable memorial. I don't think a cross is it, because mainly I think getting vaccinated is the Christian thing to do. 90% of the people dying from COVID-19 today are unvaccinated. These memorials need to be tailored to the 300,000 that have died and continue to die since they could have been vaccinated. The anti-vaxxers, the anti-maskers, the Karens you see on airplanes and in fast food establishments. I will call these people the not-so-bright people, and I have come up with a fitting memorial for them. It's a human face with a V-like peace sign across the forehead. It has a special meaning for these special people. You'll have to do a little research to find it, but it's worth it. Trust me on that. It's American Sign Language. Now that we've come up with an appropriate memorial, where do we place it? I don't think the family of the anti-vax dearly departed will want this at their home. Some of the more enlightened partners will, but I fear the majority will not see the logic in this memorial. Maybe at the cemetery. No, something else that must be mowed around. Those flower vases are bad enough. I'm thinking that the hospitals across America will love this memorial. These healthcare professionals have been working 10 or 12 hour shifts for 2 years. They are sick of the unvaccinated. Patients and family of the unvaccinated have been yelling at them, physically assaulting them, and threatening them. Something tells me they would welcome the signs on their property, in the admitting room, and in the emergency rooms and the ICU rooms. This memorial may be the last thing some of the unvaccinated see before they change cosmic address. They may go to their eternal resting place wondering, why was that guy giving me a sideways peace sign? Isn't that special?
The sound of love. Hearing the music of Johann Sebastian Bach on a classical guitar is certainly no surprise, but this guitar and this recording are very special for two important reasons. First of all, the instrument is different. The frets are in a very different place than a normal classical guitar. It's called a well-tempered guitar. That's right, after Bach's famous piece of music, the well-tempered clavier. And the second reason is this new recording has just been nominated as Best Instrumental Solo in Classical Music for the upcoming Grammys. The guitarist is Mark Gerkich, and the album is called Mock Bach. Mock is certainly a citizen of the world. He made his professional debut in Russia in 2009. He makes two regular tours to Asia each season and performs in Europe every other month. In this country, he's performed at the National Gallery of Arts, the Kennedy Center, the Dallas Opera, and was Young Artist in Residence right here in Los Angeles with the Decamera Society. But he doesn't just play for classical audiences. In 2018, Mock was invited by the legendary singer-songwriter Katie Lang to perform as the opening act for her North American leg of her Ingenue Redux tour. He's made quite a few recordings, too, an album devoted to movie themes, as well as playing flamenco music in an album called La Buena Vida, Balkanisms for Naxos music, featuring music from that part of the world, and a solo disc called Macrotonal, experimental music, and ancient music on refretted guitars. We'll be chatting with Mock today about this brand new recording. So, Mock, when did you start playing Bach?
Since I remember, pretty much, as a, you know, young guitarist, young musician, there's always that minuet in G that everyone plays. Given how long I play the instrument, that must have been 20-somewhat years ago. And then, of course, ever since.
Now you've been playing music on a well-tempered guitar. What is a well-tempered guitar?
It's a very funky guitar that looks amazingly cool, and everyone asks the question, what happened with the frets? The well-tempered guitar is sort of a play on words, taking from the historical significance of the well-tempered clavier set of works written by Johann Sebastian Bach. There's many different temperaments, or in other words, how we tune instruments, historically speaking, and the well temperament is one of them. In this case, the well-tempered guitar represents an attempt by Mr. Johann Sebastian Bach's student, Johann Kinberger, who wrote out a well-temperament as a suggestion of how to tune an instrument. And we did the very same by moving the frets around, every single fret, tuning the strings a little bit, so that it sounds very cool for certain intervals, for certain chords, and a little bit more crunchy for the others.
Is it different as a performer? What's it feel like to play that kind of fretting?
I will relate that to the first time that I ever heard a historical temperament being done, and it was quite a few years ago. I heard a demo recording of Henry Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. The crunch of the drama and then the release after the drama was so significantly impactful for me that I said, as a performer, I wanted to have that same thing. So as a performer, as a player of music by Johann Sebastian Bach, and not exclusively by Bach, other composers as well, on a guitar like this, means that I can really feel the drama much more intensely, and the aftermath of the drama, the release, the peace that comes after, even more so. So it's very exciting. It's much more exciting than playing what we would call a regular equal tempered instrument, which is basically the style of tuning that we use nowadays.
Say crunch, are you referring to dissonance? So you're saying that when things are crunchy, they're more dissonant than they are normally, and then when you resolve the dissonance into becoming a consonant, it's not as, what, crunchy?
In a sense, crunchy is when we have a dissonance that is already set in place because a certain chord, like the dominant chord, has a selection of notes that together fight each other a little bit and create a sound that is more dramatic. In the case with the well-tempered guitar, what we have is an intensified sense of that type of drama. So that same chord becomes much richer. It's almost like it's like eating a slice of pizza, which is very good, but then instead of eating that slice as is, adding some basil to it makes it shine much more. So that's what we're after.
We're talking to Mark Gurgic about his new album, Mach Bach, that was just nominated for the Best Instrumental Solo for the Grammys. Talk about consonants and dissonance. Now, the music that you've recorded in this wonderful new album, Mach Bach, are actually arrangements of music not written for the classical guitar. Johann Sebastian Bach never saw a classical guitar. It didn't exist in his day. You are playing arrangements of a solo violin piece, a solo flute piece, and also music for cello. how do you make a melodic instrument work with a harmonic instrument like a guitar?
The guitar as an instrument is a beautiful instrument that lends itself to many different attempts for arrangements. The guitar as is can play chords, can play beautiful melodies, and just kind of putting those two concepts together, we really have an instrument that's quite akin to maybe a piano. So a piano can play many different chordal structures, different arpeggiations, etc., and can assume melodic content very easily. What we did was we took sort of existing works as they are and oftentimes amplified them by adding a lot of notes from sort of nearby chords. As a flute instrument and as a violin instrument and the cello, these are all relatively melodic instruments. They sometimes play two or even three notes at a time, but it's more rare than regular. What we did is we took that and oftentimes left it in the original key and then added those bass notes, added those notes from the chord to really enrich the whole structure. So now we have the original work with the beautiful melodic content as it were, and then some more chords there to boost the whole thing up.
Music originally written for the flute by Johann Sebastian Bach from his Partita in A minor, played by Mark Gurgitsch on the well-tempered guitar. It's from his Grammy-nominated album, Mach Bach. What makes Bach so incredibly talented and fun to listen to, and fun to play if you're a flute player, is that he implies harmonies, even though a flute can only play one note at a time. And of course, as you say, a cello can play two notes simultaneously and by arpeggiating maybe three, but he implies harmonies. So what your arrangements that you play on Mach Bach, they realize these implications, that you actually play the notes that are implied by the composer?
Oh, absolutely. The writing of Bach is so very universal and so very well adaptable to really any instrument out there and voice, that just by following the music and the suggestions of implied harmonies as they are makes it, I don't want to say easy, but easier to attempt a fully rounded arrangement.
Of the solo flute partita of Bach for well-tempered guitar. Our special guest today, Mark Gurgitsch, does not follow the usual plan of having a sonata, a suite, and then that's the whole album. Instead, he begins the album with a chorale, originally sung by four sets of voices, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, chordal church music. What a fascinating idea. and then uses more chorales between the major pieces of the album, a sort of sorbet.
It's common to have big works be the entire infrastructure of an album. What we felt is needed is some kind of a glue in between, something that would tell the story and provide a thread between those big pieces. Because if the big pieces are just there as they are, then you would call it a selection of those pieces. But if carefully selected chorales are chosen and provide harmonic intent, provide narrative intent, those serve as sort of appetizer that kind of clean the palate and lead you better into the next larger piece of music. We chose four chorales to serve as tie-ins, also intros and outros between those major works. And that does make the album flow incredibly well.
And so a chorale from the St. John Passion precedes Bach's beloved Suite for solo cello. The guitarist is Mark Gurkic. The album is Mark Bach, nominated as Best Instrumental Solo for this year's Grammys. Congratulations on your Grammy nomination. What's it feel like at this point in your career to be getting a Grammy nomination? How amazing. How wonderful.
Yes, I agree. It's very amazing. There's a few layers of significance to this recognition. One is the mission that we're on, trying to popularize the well-tempered guitar or the concept. To have that recognized is a pretty special treat. It means that people are relating to it and that they think it's worthwhile noticing it. And also it means that it's cool to kind of continue on this path, that it's a project worth pursuing. The second thing that's really important for me personally, as someone coming from a relatively small country in Europe called Slovenia, I mean, let me just put it out there, I'm of mixed heritage, Bosnian and Slovenian. I don't really think there were many or any Grammys or even Grammy nominations tied to those two countries. So to have something like this happen is a proud achievement also on a national level for those two countries. And that's something that I'm extremely proud of.
Our guest today has been Mach Gurkacz. His brand new album, Mach Bach, is on Microfest Records, and we wish him all the best at the upcoming Grammys. And we'll all be watching on January 31st. I'm John Schneider.
So there's a rule I have in how to discover individuals that are worth studying or interesting within Sufism. The very critical and strict 14th century scholar Ibn Taymiyyah often wrote works in which he very strongly attacked and criticized certain Sufis as being unbelievers or heretics because they held, in his opinion, very radical views. And so the rule is that anyone that he mentions by name in those writings, those are the interesting ones. And people that he mentions include Ibn Arabi, Sadr al-Din Qunawi, Ibn al-Farid, al-Shushtari, and perhaps the most controversial of them all, the one that Ibn Taymiyyah and many others see as the most radical and most dangerous, Ibn Saba'in. His full name was Muhammad ibn Abdul Haq ibn Saba'in, and Ibn Saba'in literally means son of 70, which is obviously a rather unusual name. He has come down to us as a very controversial figure, one that is famous for holding and spreading radical views that interpreted the Islamic doctrine of oneness in a very monistic way, a doctrine which he liked to call Ghadat al-Mutlaqa, or absolute unity. He was born in 1216 or 1217 in Al-Andalus, and specifically in the Ricote Valley, which is part of the larger region of Murcia, where he also grew up and spent his formative years. This, of course, directly places him close to probably the most famous Andalusian Sufi, Ibn Arabi, who was also from Murcia and only a generation or two older than Ibn Saba'in. Because of their close proximity, both regionally but also in terms of similar lives and even teachings, the great Sheikh al-Akbar ibn Arabi often overshadows Ibn Saba'in completely. And this is a shame, because Ibn Saba'in is a very unique and fascinating figure that, in my opinion, deserves a lot more attention. We talked about Andalusia a lot in my previous videos. The 12th to 13th centuries was an especially vibrant time in which some of the most famous figures in history appeared here and also elsewhere as well. Sufism or mysticism was also flourishing in this region and often was mixed with more speculative philosophy or speculative thought in general, which tried to create a kind of synthesis between the two. Like, for example, in the famous novel Hay ibn Yaqsan by the philosopher Ibn Tufayl. One could generalize a bit and say that
the Sufis of the Western tradition in Spain and Western North Africa was more speculative in nature and implemented more philosophical terms and ideas, whereas its Eastern counterpart in places like Persia was more focused on psychological development and poetic expressions rather than speculative prose. The speculative and esoteric tendencies of their mysticism in this region seems to have been greatly influenced by the Greek tradition and indeed very much by Hermeticism. Later chroniclers talk about the Sufis of Al-Andalus and mentions that Hermeticism is especially strong among them. Writers like Ibn al-Khatib and indeed Ibn Khaldun mentions a group of people from the so-called Wadi Rikut, that is the Rukout Valley, who held radical views of absolute unity or Huadat al-Mutlaqa, and were also apparently very strongly influenced by Hermeticism. These accounts were written by people who were often very critical of this group or the ideas that they held, so it should be taken with a grain of salt. But it is very interesting that they and many others seem to mention this people of the Wadi Rikut as a unique category. It seems then that the Rikut Valley at this time was a place of great activity and an intellectual environment where a certain group of Sufis resided and held what seems to be radical views with certain monistic tendencies. Now, I would argue that probably the views held by the people in the Wadi Rikut were a locus of larger tendencies in the region of Spain generally, but as I said, much more research needs to be done on this subject. As we've seen, Ibn Saba'in was born and raised in the Rikut Valley, and thus it is highly likely that it is this intellectual environment and the masters from this region that he frequented that was the highest or largest influence to his own very unique ideas about absolute unity. It seems that these were ideas that were flourishing in Andalusia at the time, and might have had a special prominence in the Rikut Valley. It is therefore my opinion that the similarity between Ibn Arabi's unity of being and Ibn Saba'in's absolute unity should not be seen as a result of direct influence, as some have assumed, but instead as a result of sharing a common intellectual environment in medieval Spain in which these ideas were held at the time. Ibn Saba'in's spiritual masters include a man called Ibn Ahla and Ishaq Ibn al-Mara'a and Ibn Dahaq, all being supposed people of the Wadi Rikut. Other than this, Ibn Saba'in seems to have received a wide and proper education in both science and philosophy, and came to master both of these fields. Indeed, he became famous in his life for his incredible intellectual knowledge and rhetorical skills, and even those of his enemies, who were very highly critical of him, even they had to humbly admit to this fact. He also received an education in the religious sciences like the Quran and Hadith and jurisprudence. He was from a well-off family, but later in his life chose a more ascetic life as a Sufi, which is often a common theme in these kinds of biographies. It seems that in his 20s he had already cultivated a mystical and philosophical status to the point that he had a devoted group of followers. By the time he was around 30 years old, he left his home region with his group of followers, called the Sabinia, to Granada. From early on, it seems like Ibn Saba'in's thought was characterized by a leaning towards both Sufism or mysticism and philosophy, and often with a kind of synthesis of the two. He held very highly some of the philosophers and was particularly fond of Hermes, as we will see soon, but was nonetheless a Sufi through and through at the same time, concerned with spiritual practices and the cultivation of intimacy with God through intuitive experience. Sayyid Hussein Nasr writes, quote, "Ibn Saba'in embodies that synthesis between the practical spiritual life and intellectual doctrine that one finds in Ibn Masara. He would exclaim his controversial doctrines on God and the world early on, the main thrust of which is that God is the sole reality of existing things, that reality is absolute oneness, and that the world of multiplicity is an illusion. This didn't go down too well with the local sultans or the conservative jurists, and he was very much attacked for these ideas for most of his life. It may have been for this reason that he chose to relocate outside of his home region of Andalusia to the city of Ceuta, where he lived for a few years undisturbed. It is here, while in Ceuta, that he writes some of the most famous and important of his literary works. For example, it is here that he composes his by far most famous work, which is called The Sicilian Questions. Now, The Sicilian Questions is a work that was written as answers in response to certain philosophical or theological questions asked by the Christian Emperor Frederick II. This is a very fascinating document. This is the only work by Ibn Saba'in that has been completely translated into English, and is also the main reason that he is even known or famous today. But he also wrote his probably most important mystical philosophical work while staying in the city, which is known as Budd al-Arif, and in which he explicates his ideas in full force. It is said that this book angered the authorities so much that he was forced to flee again, but most likely it was due to other political reasons and changes in leadership and so on. He would then continue to relocate continuously to different cities, but always having to flee or relocate eventually, maybe because of his controversial views. He lived for a while in Algeria, where he met and became a master of the Sufi poet and his most famous student, Abul Hasan al-Shushtari. Shushtari was actually older than Ibn Saba'in and was at the time a follower of the tariqa of Abu Madian. But when he met Ibn Saba'in, he is famously said to have said to al-Shushtari, quote, "If it is paradise you desire, then go with Sheikh Abu Madian. If it is the master of paradise you desire, then let's begin." After this, al-Shushtari became his student and was devoted to him for the rest of his life, as would I if someone ever said that to me, obviously. Ibn Saba'in then lived in Cairo, Egypt for a while, where he gathered more followers, but it wasn't until he reached the city of Mecca, sometime around the year 1254, that he finally found his permanent home. Here, he became very close with the governor of Mecca himself, Sharif Abu Numay ibn Abi Sa'id. Ibn Saba'in may even have become his spiritual master, which would of course be very significant. He spent his last 20 years under the patronage of the Sharif of Mecca until his mysterious death in the year 1270 at the young age of 54. Now, there is controversy surrounding his death, as the common narrative is that he committed suicide by slitting his wrists. But in my opinion, and according to many other scholars, this is most likely not true, as the only sources we have for this is written by people who were openly hostile to him, and thus is obviously trying to paint him in a very negative light as committing a very grave sin. Some instead claim that he may have been poisoned, which could of course be true since he did still have a number of enemies around the Muslim world, or he may have fallen ill. We simply don't know. But since his death, he has nonetheless become a very infamous figure, greatly loved by his followers and vehemently criticized and attacked by his enemies and later critics. His thoughts and teachings can be said to be rather syncretic. As I mentioned earlier, he was highly educated and he seems to have had an impressive intellectual capacity. Thus, in his writings, he showcases a great mastery of both philosophy and mysticism and tries to apply both of them. But two things need to be pointed out here. Firstly, while he is highly philosophical, it is a bit uncertain if he can be firmly placed within the falsafa tradition. He held very highly some philosophers like Plato and the Muslim al-Farabi, but was highly critical of others like Ibn Rushd and even Ibn Sina, both of whom he thought was misguided. He used and applied the Aristotelian tradition in his thinking, especially in the Sicilian Questions, but he was also critical of this kind of philosophy as it conflicted with his ideas of absolute unity. Instead, Ibn Saba'in appears to have been formulating a new kind of illuminative philosophy that he sometimes referred to as the Hikmat al-Mashriq, the Eastern Wisdom, which may perhaps be referring to people like Surawardi and his philosophy. In this mystical philosophical project, he seems to be especially fond of Hermes, who is often equated with the prophet Idris in Islam. Indeed, in the introduction to his most important work, the Budd al-Arif, he praises Hermes as the greatest of sages. Quote, "I petition to God to propagate through me the wisdom that Hermes Trismegistos revealed in the earlier ages, the spiritual reality that prophetic guidance has made beneficial, the happiness that is sought out by every person of guidance, the light by which every fully actualized intellectual wishes to be illuminated, the knowledge that will no longer be broadcast or disseminated from Hermes in future ages, and the secret from which and through which and for the sake of which the prophets were sent." This lends some credibility to the idea expressed earlier that Hermeticism was especially prominent in Spain or in the Ricote Valley in particular. This isn't to say that Hermeticism was something unique, though. Hermeticism was widely popular and used by philosophers and other intellectuals in the Muslim world generally, but here we see a larger emphasis on Hermes than what is perhaps common among the Muslim philosophers. Secondly, we must remember that while Ibn Saba'in did attempt to create a kind of synthesis between intellectual philosophical knowledge and mystical experience, the two are not equal in any way. Mysticism, what we could call the Sufi aspect, dominates his writings and holds by far the most weight, but is complemented by philosophy. N. Scott Johnson writes, quote, "This is demonstrated in Ibn Saba'in's emphasis on the priority of mystical verification, tahqiq, of discursive knowledge, and more expressively in his articulation of the doctrine of absolute unity, wadat al-mutlaqa. What Ibn Saba'in emphasizes the most is a direct transcendence of plurality and experience of God's unity within ourselves, what he calls tahqiq al-tawhid. This is also the root of his criticism of Aristotelian or peripatetic philosophy, even if he does employ it sometimes himself. Aristotelian philosophy looks at the world through plurality, when in truth there is only absolute oneness. He himself says, quote, "While studying the diverse branches of science, the true Sufi sees them as a whole as mere preliminaries. The sole end which he pursues is arrival at the contemplation of the unity of the divine essence and the negation of the world and his own self." And this very conveniently brings us back to that very central aspect of his thought, what he likes to call and what others call the doctrine of absolute unity, or wadat al-mutlaqa. He likes to use this term himself, and he also employs many other terms for this kind of philosophy. Very interestingly, we have seen that Ibn Saba'in is often associated with Ibn Arabi. Ibn Arabi's doctrine is, of course, as you know, known as wadat al-wujud, or the unity of being. But as I stated in the video about Ibn Arabi, he never actually uses this term himself at all, but it was generations later that this came to be used as a technical term. And what is very fascinating is that Ibn Saba'in actually does use the term wadat al-wujud, the unity of being, to describe his own philosophy, and he was a contemporary of Ibn Arabi. The similarities between Ibn Saba'in and Ibn Arabi are many, to the point that many have said or claim that they are actually saying the same thing, but in different ways. In Ibn Saba'in's absolute unity, there is nothing but God. He often exclaims in his writings, Allahu faqat, God only, or only God. Everything in the world, including the individual self, are illusions that are non-existent, nothingness, and only God is in reality. It is characterized by an emphasis on taking flight over all multiplicity, even the many divine names, and instead an intense fixation upon the divine essence, or adhat, in itself, which is all of reality. All the intellectual sciences only really lead to this affirmation. Quote, "Man begins to desire the incomparable object, and he enters into the scientific paths which we have previously mentioned. Advancing and meditating as he will, he becomes aware that everything is but an attribute. He then acquires the conviction that the attribute of multiplicity is contained within the essence of unity, and that this is the absolute truth to which he must ascend, before which the world has no reality. He progresses from there to the reflection of the object of his desire in the world, but no longer finding there the unity for which he searches. He abandons everything, the world and the reflection of God in the world. Recognizing the nothingness of everything that he has acquired through the preliminary sciences, he understands the very voice of reality." Even when Ibn Saba'in speaks in philosophical terms, by dividing the world into objects or different realities or gradations of existence, this is all really conceptual and isn't real in the ultimate sense. In truth, there is only oneness, absolute oneness. There can be no distinction between things at all. Everything is one. So far, this may seem pretty similar to the school of Ibn Arabi and his doctrines, and it very much is, but Ibn Saba'in and his followers were a bit more radical, at least in their expressions of these ideas. While Ibn Arabi saw the world as relatively real and as being the reflections of God's infinite attributes and having all their being from God, Ibn Saba'in viewed the world and everything in it as an illusion. He didn't hold the idea that we are to know God through his reflections in the world, but that we are to pass over the names until we see only God in his true essence. Michel Chodkiewicz explains the difference between these two in very, I think, understandable terms, even if I think he overestimates the difference between the two a little bit. Quote, "Despite occasional use of similar formulas, sometimes exactly the same formulas, the differences between Ibn Arabi and Ibn Saba'in are fundamental. A metaphysic whose center is a divine solipsism has no circumference. For Ibn Arabi, God is the being of everything that is. For Ibn Saba'in, God is everything that is. The God of Ibn Arabi is the lamp of the heavens and the earth. That of Ibn Saba'in is a sun without rays whose incandescence is in itself its own end." To many, these were very radical ideas, and indeed they are radical in the sense that the unity or oneness that it expresses is a radical unity or a radical oneness. He did synthesize mysticism and philosophy, but once God's essence or the oneness of reality is realized, there is no longer any room for speculation or discursive science. Quote, "I was first led to say, I have never seen a thing without seeing God behind it. Then to say, which is closer to the truth, I have never seen a thing without seeing God with it. Then finally to say, I have never seen a thing without seeing God before it. Now I can only say, he. While these ideas of his were very controversial and he was attacked by many scholars, we shouldn't forget that he was also very much loved and admired by many others as well. The Muslim world at this time, or in any time, was not some homogeneous entity where Ibn Saba'in was an anomaly. There were many other similar movements and teachers, and many who considered his ideas to be perfectly acceptable, even if they probably weren't in a majority. For example, we should remember that the Sharif of Mecca himself was a close friend of Ibn Saba'in and may even have been his devoted student. And that, according to Vincent Cornell, quote, "when he eventually moved to Mecca, pilgrims from the Islamic West sought him out like no one else." The very bad reputation that Ibn Saba'in has had and still has can very much be attributed to his enemies painting him in a very bad light. Descriptions and opinions that have, to some degree, still survived to this day. This includes calling him things like a pantheist or heretic or hermetic philosopher who disregarded the Islamic law, even though he clearly states in his writings that, states the importance of following the Sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad and the Quran and so on. The claim that he committed suicide has also become sort of semi-accepted knowledge, even though it most likely isn't true. There is even a fictional novel written about him called A Muslim Suicide by Ben Salem Himish, which I hear is very good, by the way. The Sabiniya was run by his student Al-Shushtari in Egypt and by a man called Ibn Hud in Damascus and survived through their lines. Some of them may have been assimilated into the school of Ibn Arabi, which grew to be a lot more influential and very much eclipsed the influence of Ibn Saba'in, who is relatively forgotten today. Nonetheless, Ibn Saba'in is remembered as one of the foremost representatives of Andalusian Sufism or mysticism and philosophy, even if he isn't as well remembered as his contemporary Ibn Arabi. As I've said in the beginning, we know fairly little about him and his school, and the same can be said about the Ricote Valley and the Sufism that was practiced in Islamic Spain at the time in general. I think there's some really interesting stuff that can be discovered here if we dive deeper into it. Who were these people of the Wadi Rikut? How did they influence Ibn Saba'in? And can Ibn Saba'in and Ibn Arabi said to be baptized in the same intellectual waters that were the currents in the region at the time? And to what degree was Hermeticism influential on this movement? I think further research into this subject could give us a lot in terms of our understanding of Sufism or the history of the Islamic world in general. Ibn Saba'in may have been a very strange figure. His philosophical mysticism expresses realities and experiences that are very profound and striking, and often without compromise. But at the same time, and as he recognizes himself, he is ultimately trying to explain things or experiences which cannot be explicated in words, as they are completely beyond human conception. Therefore, the following words by Ibn Saba'in become especially haunting and telling. Quote, "He who says I mocks himself by comparison. He who says he lies. only he who keeps silent is saved. I'll see you next time.
We are coming to the end of the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started today's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Roadside Memorial. That was followed by a tune from a beautiful production of The Band's Visit, now playing at the Dolby Theater. The song was called Answer Me. And you can see The Band's Visit through December 19th. Go to BroadwayInHollywood.com for more information. Then we heard a tune by Aaron Schneider on accordion, Give Me Your Hand. And that was followed by my colleague John Schneider interviewing Mac Gurgich. Mac has an album out called Mac Bach that's been nominated for a Grammy. After that, we heard a talk by Philip Holm about Ibn Saba'in. And then we just wrapped up the show with a tune that Philip produced with his band called Ikar, Blinded by the Lights. Be sure to check out his channel on YouTube called Let's Talk Religion. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with more of the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!